You're listening to the English language news of Khan, the Israeli Public Broadcasting Corporation.
It's 8 p.m. in Israel, Thursday, May the 2nd, 2024, in the headlines. Prime Minister Netanyahu says Israel will do what it must to defeat its enemies, including in Rafah. Israel awaits the Hamas response to the latest hostage release ceasefire proposal. The IDF Chief of Staff and Defense Minister agree on a round of senior general staff appointments to the criticism of some members in the cabinet. Turkey announces it is cutting all trade ties with Israel. U.S. President Biden slams violent college campus protests and says they won't prompt a revision of policy on the region. The National Security Council raises the travel advisor for Malmo, Sweden, ahead of the Eurovision Song Contest. No significant change through Saturday in the weather. Good evening. This is Nomi Segal with the news. On day 209 of the war, the War Cabinet is meeting and the expanded security cabinet is slated to convene later to discuss the negotiations on the latest proposed hostage release and ceasefire deal with Hamas. Israel is awaiting Hamas's response to the proposal amid growing international concerns over an IDF ground operation in Rafah in the southern Gaza Strip, where remaining Hamas battalions are concentrated. A Lebanese network, Al Miadin, which is considered close to the pro-Iranian axis, cited what it calls informed Palestinian sources as describing a clear and positive development in the negotiations in Cairo. This against the backdrop of what it claimed Israel's dropping of conditions it placed for the return of displaced Gazans to their homes and an IDF withdrawal from the Gaza Strip, along with presentation of a document described as a serious base for negotiations that could soon lead to a comprehensive agreement. The sources are quoted as saying that the most important issue for Hamas is yet to be resolved, which is anchoring a ceasefire in clear wording. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said today that Israel will do everything necessary on every front to overcome its enemies. In remarks at a memorial ceremony for Etzel fighters, Netanyahu said, "We are committed to achieving victory. There are differences of opinion among us regarding actions on both faraway and nearby arenas, but at the end of the discussion, I made a decision. We acted there and we will act here. We will do what is necessary to win and overcome our enemies, including in Rafah," Netanyahu stated. Defense Minister Yoav Gallant spoke with his U.S. counterpart, Lloyd Austin, overnight and briefed him on the IDF's ongoing activities and preparation for future operations in Gaza. He also discussed the humanitarian effort, including the opening of new land crossings and the significant increase in volume of aid over the past month, doubling the number of aid trucks entering Gaza. Hezbollah's ongoing aggression was also discussed, and Gallant informed him that Israel is committed to returning Israel's northern communities to their homes, the residents of those communities, whether it be via diplomatic agreement or by military action. The two also discussed Iranian threats to regional stability and to Israel's security. Gallant emphasized the importance of maintaining a united front and joint regional efforts to counter Iran's proxy attacks and nuclear ambitions. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken, in an interview with the NBC network, was asked about Prime Minister Netanyahu's recent declaration that Israel will enter Rafah with or without a deal. Blinken said, "People say things. Let's focus on what they're doing." A government spokesperson said today that there is no daylight between Israel and the United States regarding preparations for a military operation in Rafah, and that prior to any such offensive, the IDF would do its utmost to evacuate Palestinian civilians from harm's way. The spokesperson, Raquel Karamson, was speaking in an online briefing.
As the prime minister has stated, the operation in Rafah is required to eliminate the terror threat by Hamas, and we are in preparations to do that, to enter Gaza. As we've conducted ourselves throughout this war, the IDF has very methodically conducted this war with a lot of concern to the humanitarian cost to the civilians in the area. And that is the same thing that we're going to do here in Rafah. The civilian population in the area is the focus here at the beginning of this operation, and we're going to be doing everything we can to move them out of harm's way before then moving into Rafah and destroying the remaining Hamas battalions.
Would you please clear up the miscommunication that the U.S. is against Israel going into Rafah? White House security spokesperson John Kirby said that the U.S. wants to see the battle plans before they are put into place, so the largest of civilians can be protected. So is it correct to say that Israel will discuss their battle plans with the U.S. before the war plans are carried out in Rafah?
As we all know, yesterday, the Prime Minister met with Secretary Blinken, and the two met for over an hour. And Secretary Blinken then additionally met with other members of the War Cabinet. So there is no daylight between Washington and Israel on our plans. We are in constant communication with them and as we move forward with these plans. And, you know, I think the United States understands very much, and we are on the same page in terms of the war goals, which is to return our hostages from Hamas and to eliminate Hamas and to make sure that they are never again able to pose a threat to us.
Raquel Karamson of the National Public Diplomacy Directorate. A number of families of hostages and supporters demonstrated this morning and temporarily blocked the main Ayalon highway in Tel Aviv. Some held banners reading, "It's either Rafah or the hostages. Choose life." A sukkah from the October 7th attack on Kibbutz Be'eri was also brought to Tel Aviv, urging the government to conclude a hostage release deal now. Lily Munder, who's had several family members murdered and abducted by terrorists from kibbutz near Oz in the Gaza periphery on October 7th, appeared before the Parliamentary National Security Committee today and described the difficult daily reality she and the family members of other murdered and captives experience and appealed for help. "I have many panic attacks," she said. "I'm afraid to walk on the street, that someone might shoot me or abduct me. I think in my country I should be safe. They did this to my family, so what will protect me?" she asked. The IDF spokesman has announced that following a lengthy process, the defense minister and Yoav Gallant and IDF chief of staff, Lieutenant General Herzi Halevi, have agreed to promote a number of commanders who stood out on the battlefield and in the general command during the Iron Swords War to appointments in the General Command Staff Forum. Brigadier General Avi Blut will be appointed head of the IDF Central Command. Brigadier General Shlomi Binder will be named head of IDF Intelligence. He succeeds Aharon Khalifa, who announced he was resigning over the failings of the October 7th attack. Brigadier General Dan Goldfuss will be named head of the Northern Forces and Ground Maneuvers Directorate. Brigadier General David Bar Khalifa will be appointed head of the IDF Personnel Directorate. And Brigadier General Aviad Dagan will be named head of the IDF Technological Branch. They will be promoted to rank of Major General and assume their roles gradually in the coming months. The move drew some criticisms within the coalition. Diaspora Minister Amichai Shikli and two other Likud lawmakers earlier wrote to the defense minister to express opposition to the IDF chief of staff's recent round of senior appointments within the IDF. The general staff, which besides impressive achievements in the war, bears direct responsibility for the security failure of October 7th, cannot involve itself in promoting senior officials, wrote Shikli alongside MK's Moshe Saada and Dan Eluz, adding that some of the appointments that have come up concern senior officers whose degree of responsibility for the events of October 7th is still unknown. Their statement was welcomed by Finance Minister Bezalel Smotrich, who has repeatedly insisted that the Army's leadership has no mandate to design a new and reformed IDF during wartime. In the north, Israel Air Force aircraft struck a number of Hezbollah military infrastructure sites in South Lebanon overnight. In addition, fighter jets struck a building where a terrorist was identified inside. In the Gaza Strip, Israel aircraft and artillery struck sites used by terrorists to fire mortars and rockets at Israeli forces in the central Gaza Strip yesterday. There were no Israeli casualties in those incidents. The U.S. military aims to have the temporary pier that it is building off the coast of Gaza up and running in the coming days, despite weather that is hampering preparations. The White House National Security Council spokesperson John Kirby told reporters, "We're hoping within days. I think that's still a hope." Israeli security forces today removed from an area near Arad in the south the remnant of another surface-to-surface missile that was intercepted during last month's Iranian drone and missile attack on Israel. The IDF reminds the public and hikers to adhere to home front directives should they encounter a suspicious object, not to touch it and to report it to the police hotline. In other news, the Shin Bet Israel Security Agency has uncovered a terror cell from the Jenin area village of Yabid that received instructions from an Islamic Jihad command in Lebanon and planned to remotely detonate bombs against IDF forces in the area. The three cell members were arrested in January. During their arrests, security forces seized explosives that were ready for use. Charges were filed against the three in the Samaria military court. And civil administration personnel accompanied by security forces removed illegally built structures from a settlement outpost, Givat Ormeir in Binyamin. The construction was on privately owned Palestinian land. Law enforcement authorities went to the site last night to remove Israelis who had gone there illegally, but they returned this morning. Attorney General Gali Baharav Miara has given the green light for Israeli authorities to close the Al Jazeera network in Israel. The issue is slated to be put to a vote this evening before the cabinet. If approved, orders would be issued to cease the Qatari-based channel's broadcasts in Arabic and English through the content providers in Israel, closing the offices and blocking access to websites. Baharav Miara said there was a significant legal difficulty since the channel was not given the right to a hearing before signing the order, but she would not block it. The Bloomberg News Agency reports that Turkey is suspending all trade ties with Israel. Econ Reporter says two Turkish sources confirmed the report that has placed a total ban on export and import ties with Israel. Israel's foreign ministry, Israel Katz, wrote in response that on the platform X that the Turkish president acts like a dictator who is destroying the interests of the Turkish people and of business people and ignores international trade agreements. I have instructed the director general of my ministry to immediately hold a discussion on how to create alternatives to trade with Turkey from the level of local production and import from other countries, he said. Low-cost airline Wizz Air has decided to cancel a large number of its flights to Israel, according to Khan. This after the company resumed flights to Israel only about 2 months ago. This is the only budget airline currently operating in Israel, and cancellation affects thousands of Israelis who purchased tickets for the summer and are expected to receive cancellation notices in the coming days. The company did not immediately respond to the report. And ahead of the Eurovision Song Contest that will be held in the Swedish city of Malmo next week, the National Security Council has upgraded the travel warning for the city from level 2, a potential threat, to level 3, a moderate threat, and recommends that Israelis due to travel to the city reconsider the necessity of the trip. The travel warning notes that Malmo is known for having a high concentration of Syrian, Lebanese, Iraqi, and Iranian migrants, and a focus for anti-Israeli protests, which occur on a weekly basis and frequently include incitement, calls to attack Jews and Israelis, and the burning of Israeli flags. The advisory states that visitors to Malmo are requested to download the IDF Homefront Command app in order to receive National Security Council updates quickly and in real time in the event of an incident in Malmo during the Eurovision contest. Israel is represented there by Eden Golan. Turning to the campus protests in the United States, police finished clearing a fortified anti-Israel encampment of protesters at UCLA in California after hundreds of them defied police orders to leave overnight. Reports said that the two buses filled with detainees had driven off. U.S. President Joe Biden says that the violent protests sweeping U.S. college campuses over the Israel-Gaza war will not prompt him to revise his policies on the region. In a state on the demonstrations, Biden said there is no place in America for anti-Semitism or threats of violence against Jewish students, and no place for Islamophobia or discrimination against Arab Americans or Palestinian Americans. He said students have the right to protest, but not the right to cause chaos. Here are his remarks.
We've all seen the images, and they put to the test two fundamental American principles. The first is the right to free speech and for people to peacefully assemble and make their voices heard. The second is the rule of law. Both must be upheld. We are not an authoritarian nation where we silence people or squash dissent. The American people are heard. In fact, peaceful protest is in the best tradition of how Americans respond to consequential issues. But, neither are we a lawless country. We are a civil society, and order must prevail. Throughout our history, we've often faced moments like this because we are a big, diverse, free-thinking, and freedom-loving nation. In moments like this, there are always those who rush in to score political points. But this isn't a moment for politics. It's a moment for clarity. So let me be clear. Peaceful protest in America. Violent protest is not protected. Peaceful protest is. It's against the law when violence occurs. Destroying property is not a peaceful protest. It's against the law. Vandalism, trespassing, breaking windows, shutting down campuses, forcing the cancellation of classes and graduations. None of this is a peaceful protest. Threatening people, intimidating people, instilling fear in people is not peaceful protest. It's against the law. Dissent is essential to democracy, but dissent must never lead to disorder or to denying the rights of others so students can finish the semester and their college education. Look, it's basically a matter of fairness. It's a matter of what's right. There's the right to protest, but not the right to cause chaos. People have the right to get an education, the right to get a degree, the right to walk across the campus safely without fear of being attacked. But let's be clear about this as well. There should be no place on any campus, no place in America for anti-Semitism or threats of violence against Jewish students. There is no place for hate speech or violence of any kind, whether it's anti-Semitism, Islamophobia, or discrimination against Arab Americans or Palestinian Americans. It's simply wrong. There's no place for racism in America. It's all wrong. It's un-American. I understand people have strong feelings and deep convictions. In America, we respect the right and protect the right for them to express that. But it doesn't mean anything goes. It needs to be done without violence, without destruction, without hate, and within the law. You know, make no mistake, as president, I will always defend free speech, and I will always be just as strong in standing up for the rule of law. That's my responsibility to you, the American people, and my obligation to the Constitution. Thank you very much.
Mr. President, have the protests forced you to reconsider any of the
U.S. President Joe Biden. The U.S. House of Representatives voted last night to pass the Bipartisan Anti-Semitism Awareness Act, a vote that comes amid heightened concerns over anti-Semitism with Israel at war with Hamas and as pro-Palestinian protests have sprung up on college campuses across the United States. Supporters of the legislation say it will help combat anti-Semitism on college campuses, but opponents say it overreaches and threatens to chill free speech. The House vote was 320 to 91, with 70 Democrats and 21 Republicans voting against the bill. The bill will next need to be taken up by the Senate. In Washington, Republican senators have condemned the pro-Palestinian demonstrations at university campuses across the U.S. and called on President Joe Biden to denounce the protests, which, as we heard, he did a short while ago. The violent protests. Speaking on Capitol Hill, Arkansas Senator Tom Cotton slammed the demonstrations and encampments nationwide, nicknaming them Little Gazas and decrying them as disgusting cesspools of anti-Semitic hate, full of pro-Hamas sympathizers, fanatics, and freaks. First, Senator Cotton, followed by Senator Jody Ernst of Iowa.
We're here to discuss the Little Gazas that have risen up on campuses across America and the liberal college administrators and politicians who refuse to restore law and order and to protect other students. These little Gazas are disgusting cesspools of anti-Semitic hate, full of pro-Hamas sympathizers, fanatics, and freaks. When will the president himself, not his mouthpieces, condemn these hate-filled little Gazas? President Biden needs to denounce Hamas's campus sympathizers without equivocating about Israelis fighting a righteous war of survival. Instead, Joe Biden is putting more pressure on Israel these days than he is on Hamas itself or on the pro-Hamas chapters on America's campuses. But I guess that's what we should expect from the leader of a Democratic Party that has let its anti-Semitic elements fester and grow for years.
We shouldn't support them with our dollars. The donors should withdraw their funding. And you know what? I'm going to go a step further. Businesses across the United States, when they see that little Harvard diploma, UCLA, Columbia, those businesses, maybe they should hang a sign out that says, graduates need not apply. They need not apply. So presidents, you better get a handle on what's going on your colleges and universities, because it is absolutely unacceptable behavior. And I think we, as elected representatives of our constituencies, need to ensure that federal dollars are not going to these institutions.
U.S. Senator Jody Ernst of Iowa. Israel's President Isaac Herzog issued a special urgent message today of support for Jewish communities around the world in light of the dramatic resurgence in anti-Semitism and following hostilities and intimidation against Jewish students on campuses across the U.S. in particular. In his message, Herzog told World Jewry that Israel sees the hostility and threats rising against them and feels insulted by a breach of faith and a breach of friendship. He reminded World Jewry that Israel is here for them.
Dear sisters and brothers, to our friends on campuses and in Jewish communities across the United States and all over the world, to those who stand by and defend the Jewish people and the state of Israel, to all people of goodwill. From Jerusalem, our eternal capital, I say to you, the people of Israel are with you. We hear you. We see the shameless hostility and threats. We feel the insult, the breach of faith and breach of friendship. We share the apprehension and concern. We see prominent academic institutions, halls of history, culture, and education contaminated by hatred and anti-Semitism, fueled by arrogance and ignorance, and driven by moral failings and disinformation. We watch in horror as the atrocities of October 7th against Israel are celebrated and justified. We hear you. We recognize your heroic efforts. We are with you, and we are here for you. In the face of violence, harassment, and intimidation, as masked cowards smash windows and barricade doors, as they assault the truth and manipulate history, together we stand strong. Together we will continue building our flourishing, life-affirming nation. As they chant for intifada and genocide, we will work together to free our hostages held by Hamas and fight for civil liberties of the entire free world and our right to believe and belong, for the right to live proudly, peacefully, and securely as Jews, as Israelis, anywhere. Next week, the Jewish people will mark Yom HaShoah, Holocaust Memorial Day. We will speak of the dark times of the past, and we will remember the miracle of our rebirth in our ancient homeland, the Jewish Democratic State of Israel, and throughout the Jewish world. Together we shall overcome. In the face of this terrifying resurgence of anti-Semitism, do not fear. Stand proud. Stand strong for your freedom. Israel stands with you. Israel cares for you. We care for you. We are here for you. We will know better times ahead, and together we will say, Am Israel Chai.
President Isaac Herzog. Professor Yossi Shein, Professor of International Affairs at Tel Aviv University and Georgetown, says the current anti-Israel, anti-Semitic demonstrations on U.S. campuses has revealed an avalanche of hate building up for decades. He told reporter Ariel O'Sullivan that the demonstrations are the violent radicalization of the freedom of expression.
So we've seen these protests that are going on, and in some ways it almost looks like it's a fad. You know, the people put on a keffiyeh and they come chant these slogans. Should we be concerned about this here?
Of course we should be concerned. This is not just like a few people chanting. This is an avalanche. Mm. Avalanche of hate, avalanche of radicalism on campuses that comes to debunk the nature of Israel, Zionism, and the memory of the Holocaust. It's also an attack on the values of the West in many ways, which are becoming more and more associated in the minds and hearts of those demonstrators with the crimes of Israel, quote unquote. Hmm. We see the scale of this. It's all over the place. It was built up for decades, and now it's really exploding. So one should not underestimate this event or this development and the repercussions into the future.
You're saying it's been under the surface. It's just coming up now because of maybe the Gaza war. But, I mean, here in Israel, we're kind of incredulous. We say to ourselves, don't these people know the truth? How can they be so twisted?
Because the truth is not something that is black and white in the minds of people. And in the storytelling of the Middle East. To begin with, we have a war in Gaza. It began with October 7th, with the massacre of Jews, the infiltration of criminals to Israel, and all the horrific crimes which they committed. And after that, a war ensued. So people begin where they want to begin. They want to minimize what they want to minimize. They want to see what they want to see. But this is not only the demonstrators. Look what's happening in the ICC, in the International Court of Justice. Look what's happening in the administration, the United States. Look what's happening in the United Nations, around the globe. So in this story, the narrative of the story is very important to understand. For some people, it's not the narrative of the October 7th. For them, it's the narrative of the destruction of Gaza. For others, it's the narrative of the Palestinian flight in 1948. Hmm. Yet others are talking about the occupation in 1967. There are too many beginnings here, and everybody is adopting their own narrative. It's not a matter that this is all skewing reality, truth, and false, but it means that the history is being written in a different fashion from place to place.
I want to ask you about the behavior of the leadership of some of these universities like Columbia, UCLA. I mean, how do you rate them? What should they have done?
I can tell you that, first of all, it's a tough choice to have because they are facing students' demonstrations. So in general, students' demonstration is part and parcel of democracy, free speech, freedom of expression, and all the goodies of liberalism and freedoms. And yet what you see is the radicalization, the violence, the anti-Semitic expressions, the terror on campus, and the administration is constantly torn between its desire for order and its responsibility to give space for expression. And the pressures are coming to bear from many of the faculty, from students, from outside, on many accounts, and of course of donors, et cetera, et cetera. It's not an easy call for any administrator, especially in places where the student body is kind of diverse. There's lots of, you know, we're paying lip service to diversity. What does it mean, diversity? What does it mean, truth? It's all of these issues that are part of the internal American debate about the role of the humanities, the role of the state, the role of the United States, because the United States itself is very much an ally of Israel from day one of the October 7th event, and is supporting Israel with weapons, with geopolitical assistance all around. And but is also sometimes critical on humanitarian aid to Gaza. And now, of course, there's also the resolution in Congress on issue of anti-Semitism.
Yes.
But what we have to make a distinction here is between what is happening here, which is over there, we are over there, and over here, which is in America. These are two different domains. One is the Israeli case, the other is the anti-Semitic case, or the attacks on Jewish students. The fact that Jewish students no longer feel comfortable on campus. They feel afraid. Some of them are claiming that they've been terrorized from day one of the events. This is a big deal for America, and this is something which is completely out of the question of the Israeli-Palestinian issue. Albeit, one can say, as I've written in my book, The Israeli Century, there is a process of the Israelization of Judaism.
Right.
It is that every Jew, wherever he or she is, are associated or immediately with Israel. Either it's guilt by association, or either they are condemned by association, or they love Israel by association. Doesn't matter.
You know, some of these people protesting are Jewish people.
Yeah. Some of the Jewish youngsters on campuses who are not so well equipped with the subtleties. You know, people like to see, when they talk about, think about proportionality. Lots of times people talk, what about proportionality? What does it mean, proportionality? They come, behead people, kill them, burn them to death, and rape them. And when we move with the army, they say, you kill too much. You abuse too much power, and so on. So what does it mean, proportionality? Should we go in and rape and behead and torture? These words have been skewed. These words have come to signify the bankruptcy of thought, the bankruptcy of analysis, of logic, and also of the hierarchy of values. How do you really work this out? It's very tough, and the administrators are caught in between. Remember when they had hearing on Capitol Hill, they were caught with the word context. Remember the word context?
Okay.
Yeah. What does it mean? Put it in context.
Put it in context, right.
Yeah. Someone said, do you condemn the killing of all the Jews? So it depends on the context. In the context of what? She meant the president of Penn University, I think, the sort of like of free speech. Can we say it? Or is it a threat to the Jews, a direct threat? Did they feel the threat? All of this, you constantly have to walk a fine line of finding truth and force. You need leaders to say, this is blasphemy. This is unacceptable. I don't deal with all kind of like the vagaries of the language. Wrong and right have to be decided and then get involved. Now, putting police on campus and putting troops on rooftops, as you see, which is kind of like the images of authoritarianism is being presented by the revolutionary mode on campuses as attack on freedom. At the same time, when law and order is being broken, when fear and terror is taking place, when buildings are stormed and damage is caused and havoc is built, if you don't stop it, when are you going to stop it? When it's going to be too late and people will be killed?
It seems like it's almost like Kristallnacht in American campuses sometimes, people chanting these things. Have you, in your experiences, ever seen such a rise in anti-Semitism in the United States?
Look, I will answer two. You asked me two questions. One is Kristallnacht. I don't think it's Kristallnacht in any fashion. Mm-hmm. Kristallnacht was orchestrated by the state itself, by the Nazi regime. The Jews were the victims. The regime from top mobilized the bottom. Here you have manifestations of attacks on Jews, but the regime, the American regime, the government, the local government, the authorities, even the universities, are responding. Sometimes they're responding too late, but or sometimes not early enough. But nevertheless, they're responding, they're against it, and they will be mobilized, and there will be a counterattack, as we see now in Congress, with the initiation of the anti-Semitic, the new law that just passed in Congress last night. So I don't like this comparison. In terms of whether we have witnessed something like that in the past, not in terms of the attacks on Jews, even though we had that before. We had that after September 11. We had that in Europe times before. We had the equation of Zionism with racism in the United Nations 1975. We had during the Intifada, the first, the second Intifada. We had many episodes of such attacks, but not in this scale all around America, and not in such the veracity is really immense here. But historically speaking, America also knew very difficult times. Remember during the heyday of the 60s and the students riot because of Vietnam, and that led even to the killing of students on the campus of Kent. Remember that?
Yes.
There were, of course, issues pertaining to the struggle of students in America against the apartheid regime in South Africa. And in the 80s, I was at that time a PhD student at Yale. I remember all those riots. But I don't remember this is taking such a twist in terms of like the legacy of democracy and liberalism in the campuses and anti-Semitism against other students on campuses. In the Vietnam War, it was not against other students. In the apartheid, it was against the regime in South Africa. Here, the Jews are being blamed, and the Jewish organizations are also shocked. Jewish parents are shocked. Students are shocked by how it started to reverberate from criticism of Israel to hating the Jews.
Let me ask you one final question. Do you think this is going to fade out maybe with summer break?
First of all, likely that these things will, I don't know if it will fade out, but these things will slow down. You know, the police is interfering. The institutions are responding. Students who have acted violently will not be able to finish their semesters or will be kicked out or whatever. And yes, indeed, we see also the damage caused to all the graduation ceremonies around America. We are now at the time of the graduation period, early May. It's when everybody's marching and the parents are coming, the grandparents. This should be joyous time. And this is such tense time. And I don't think many of the campus will be able to celebrate. And naturally, you know, when people go into summer vacation, it will not be the same. Whether it will flare up again in September, it's hard to predict. Lots of things depends also what will happen here. And that's the distinction between over there and over here. Because lots of things happening here. The war in Gaza is not ending yet. The Middle East is truly so volatile, and things can erupt in any minute in the north. And we know what's going on with Iran. So lots of things are not settled in any way and fashion. But this is a very, very delicate moment in Israel's history and in Jewish history of modernity. And many people feel it, sense it in their gut. They know that something very bad is happening. And it also relates to how the American, and not only America, in France, in Britain, even in Australia, many, many places in the world, how the authorities there will react, what they will do. And so this is, we're going to watch and see how this develops.
Professor Yossi Shein, author of the book, The Israeli Century. Taking a look at the headlines this evening, Prime Minister Netanyahu says Israel will do what it must to defeat its enemies, including in Rafah. Israel awaits the Hamas response to the latest hostage release ceasefire proposal. The IDF chief of staff and defense minister agree on a round of senior general staff appointments, prompting objections from ministers Ben-Gvir and Smotrich. Ben-Gvir calls for the prime minister to fire the defense minister over the matter. They oppose the appointments by command, IDF command, that was involved in the October 7th failings. Turkey has reportedly decided to suspend all trade ties with Israel. U.S. President Biden slams violent college campus protests and says they won't prompt a reconsideration of policy on the region. The National Security Council raises the travel advisory for Malmo, Sweden, this coming ahead of the Eurovision Song Contest there. No significant change through Saturday. Economic news, the wave of price increases in the economy. The food giant Strauss has announced a price update of dozens of dairy products by an average of 1.6%. The company also stated that among the products that will become more expensive are cheese, whipping cream, and milk. This is the second price increase by Strauss in 2 months. Yesterday, Tnuva announced it was raising its prices by about 4.5%. And the God and Tara dairies have also announced price increases. On Highway 4 near Bnei Brak, Haredi Orthodox demonstrators blocked the southbound lane in protest over the bill to be passed regulating military service exemptions for Haredim. Yesterday, the High Court of Justice gave the government an extension until May 16th to submit its plan for military service for yeshiva students. The threatened high school strike. The chair of the Secondary School Teachers Union, Ron Erez, says that without a signed agreement, the new school year will not open. He told a news conference that he will cut off contact with the education ministry. What the education minister wants to do, Erez claimed, is privatize the educational system and dismantle the organization's work, organizational work, and turn us into contract workers. We will not open the school year on September 1st if there is no signed agreement. High school teachers have been enacting various sanctions this year, accusing the Treasury of failing to move forward on an agreement in principle for a new wage agreement. The Judicial Selection Committee convened today to discuss appointments of district court judges in Tel Aviv, the Central District, and Beersheba. This follows 2 years during which no such appointments were made. According to data released by the National Insurance Institute ahead of Holocaust Martyrs and Heroes Remembrance Day, which will be marked beginning Sunday evening, there are currently some 131,000 Holocaust survivors in Israel who receive allowances from the Social Security Institute. Nearly a quarter of them are over the age of 90. Against the backdrop of the heightened emotional tensions ahead of Israel's Memorial Day for Fallen Soldiers, Defense Minister Yoav Gallant held deliberations today with the Public Council for Preservation of the Memory of the IDF Fallen. Gallant said bereavement is a most common shared experience for society. Even the fallen come from different views and positions. He called on all public representatives to go to the military cemeteries on Memorial Day and to place disagreement and arguments aside. Representatives from the government and the Knesset must be at the cemeteries. I call on all public representatives, whoever they are, to uphold the principle of the memory of the fallen and their legacy, to act in a stately manner of partnership and unity, and not to exploit the platform for other interests which desecrate them. The Paris Center for Peace and Innovation has partnered with acclaimed photographer Ziv Koren in presenting the exhibition the 7th of October, a powerful and harrowing accounting through his camera lens of the traumatic attack on Israel and the events that followed. Each image in the exhibition bears witness to what happened and conveys a different story of pain, grief, and memory, alongside courage, renewal, and even hope. A portion of proceedings from the exhibition will support the return of the hostages. Efrat Duvdevani, general director of the Paris Center for Peace and Innovation, told us how the exhibition came about.
So I can tell you a bit about the history of what made us connect together, and then I'll talk a bit about the exhibition. We know for a fact that we're going to expect many groups of Jewish communities coming over to Israel, and many of them want to identify with what went on here on the 7th of October and want to see for themselves and feel what it felt like. And we thought that the best way to do it was actually to approach Ziv Koren and ask him to display here is exhibition and let people from delegations from all over the world to come over here to the Paris Center and see what happened with their own eyes, because we believe that a picture can say what, you know, millions of words can say. And the pictures speak for themselves, and they're very, very powerful. Now, Ziv Koren is a very well-known photographer, and at the 7th of October, already noontime, he was in the south of Israel, and he came over with his motorcycle. His motorcycle was being actually hit, and he was also a target of many bullets from all over. And from that moment on, he did not stop taking pictures of what we call the album of our life. And he took pictures of what happened on that horrific day, the 7th of October. Afterwards, he came into the villages themselves and the kibbutzim, and also took pictures. And we see in these pictures what happened in children's houses, in children's bed, what happened with the survivors. He actually went over to the Nova Festival site, but he also accompanied people from the Nova party and people from the southern part of Israel as they were in the recovery journey in the hospitals. And afterwards, there was a very, very moving, you see, like a sort of group picture where you see, first of all, a baby who was burned badly, and you see her parents were in a coma, and he took the pictures, and the agreement he had with the family was that he would use these pictures only after the parents woke up and would give their consent. And thankfully they woke up, they gave their consent, and then he had the honor of actually joining them in their journey to recovery. And he shows them in the hospital, he shows them, you know, being better. And then afterwards, which is super moving, he shows them coming over for the first time to see their house. After months that they were in coma and afterwards recovered, and they see their burnt down house, and it's like a full circle, and it's a super powerful exhibition. It's going to be open to the public. We are going to, it's going to be with tickets, but of course we're going to have the ticket sent, the money sent over to the hostages unit, where they will use it you know, to help the hostages and to help their families. And so we invite everybody to come over. I won't say enjoy, but I will definitely say identify. I will say that when you go through this exhibition, you feel the sense of what went on and you see the full scale of what went on there. I believe it's a must exhibition, and I urge everyone to come over and see it.
Well, certainly even looking at some of the images online, not in the space of their being displayed, it really rolls back to that moment. Yet, as you mentioned, this is called the 7th of October and captures what happened on that day, but there's an arc here. So is it also about the trauma or also about the recovery or the dealing with the trauma?
So first of all, we're showing what went on. And the name of the exhibition is Hashiv'a Boktober, the 7th of October. And it has a double meaning. First of all, Shiv'a was 7th of October is when it happened, but also Shiv'a is a mourning period. So we're showcasing here what happened, but we're also looking at people recovering from it, from what happened. We're not hiding anything. We're not trying to make it seem like, you know, pink colors and, you know, rainbow colors and everything. We're showing it how it was, but we are showing people, some of the people there during the recovery. But what we're looking at here is and this was especially important for us to have it in the Paris Center, is that we're first of all showing what happened, the trauma of what happened, but afterwards, after the after you walk through the exhibition, you will get the opportunity to walk through the Innovation Center. And walking through the Innovation Center gives you a sense that is over here, gives you a sense of optimism. It gives you a sense that you're able to dream big. And it gives you back a sense of, you know, of power and a sense of nechama, a comfort. So this is it. You see the whole picture. Nobody's hiding behind anything. But you still get the sense that life goes on and we're here to live the life and we're here to look ahead. And the way to look ahead and continue forward is first of all understanding what went on. And it's not only for Israelis. This exhibition is also very much for the use of delegations from all over the world. Because the rhetoric that is now surrounding Israel all over the world is so horrible. And they come over here, they will see what went on, because as I said at the beginning, one picture says the story that a million words can't say. And it shows what went on, and I believe that this is something that will be a lot of importance to people who are coming over here, if they're Israelis or if they're from abroad.
The images are incredibly powerful and right. They bear witness. How was the curatorial process undertaken?
So actually, Ziv took 2,000 photos every day. And so you have to imagine that it was a lot of curating work here to do. Because we had to show only 55 pictures, and we're also showing 100 more pictures on screen. So it had to do with a lot of curating work here in the Paris Center together with Ziv. I can tell you that except for maybe one picture that we said that it is too much for people to see, we actually gave our consent to everything. What we did is that we understand that there are a few pictures which are very, very hard to see. And so what we did is that we have a special section that we give you a warning before, disclaimer, and we're saying these are hard pictures. And then you can choose, you know, if you want to go there, you go there. If you don't want to go there, you don't have to go there. You know, there are different types in the world. I, for instance, have to see everything with a microscope. But there's other people who don't want to see. And so we put this disclaimer in front, and then, you know, people can decide what they want to see and what they can avoid. I think maybe the magnitude of putting all these pictures in one space is something that really is really hard to see. But, you know, it's what happened here. I believe, for instance, that it's something that, you know, this is a way to deal with things. You come over and you see it. We actually invited over some people from not from the Paris Center and asked them to tell us what they feel. To give us their feedback. And yes, some of them said it was very hard. So the pictures that we understood were very hard, we put them aside in a place where they have a disclaimer before.
Well, as you mentioned, it's very important at this time to have this documentation of what happened here.
Exactly, exactly.
So when and where can one see the exhibition?
So the exhibition is taking place at the Paris Center for Peace and Innovation, and it's in Jaffa. You do have to buy tickets ahead at our website. And as I said, the proceedings go to the hostages. And we will, at the website, we will publish the days and the time where the exhibition is open.
Efrat Duvdevani, General Director of the Paris Center for Peace and Innovation. The exhibition opens to the public on May 4th. Information can be found on the site paris-center.org. Before the weather and return headlines, a bit of music. Yishai Libo, Lashuva Baita, returning home.
הגיע הזמן להתעורר, לעזוב הכל, להתגבר, לשוב הביתה, לא לחפש מקום אחר. הגיע הזמן להשתנות, גם אם פספסנו תחנות, אפשר לרדת, יש רכבת, חזרה לשכונות. הכל אפשר רק אם נרצה, המחפש תמיד מוצא, גם אם הוא נמצא, אישם הרחק בקצה. דתות שמיים לא ננעלו, כשהבן קורא אצילו, אבא שבשמיים מגיע אפילו. אפילו שעשינו משהו רע, הוא מוכל וסולח, מוכל וסולח, מושיט ידו לעזרה ונותן ברחמיו את הכוח לתקן ולשוב אליו. לברוח אז מאחת, אם כבר לקחת אז לקחת בשביל לתת. וזה הזמן להתקרב, לא לפחד מהכאב, ואם לתת אז כבר לתת מכל הלב. הכל אפשר רק אם נרצה, המחפש תמיד מוצא, גם אם הוא נמצא אישה מרחק בקצה. דתות שמיים לא ננעלו, כשהבן קורא אצילו, אבא שבשמיים מגיע אפילו. אפילו שעשינו משהו רע, הוא מוכל וסולח, מוכל וסולח, מושיט ידו לעזרה ונותן ברחמה את הכוח לתקן ולשוב. אפילו שעשינו משהו רע, הוא מוכל וסולח,
and the weather outlook tomorrow and Saturday the same. Sunday, chance of local rain in the north, gathering strength overnight and spreading to the center. The temperatures forecast for tonight and tomorrow: Jerusalem 14 to 23, Tel Aviv 21 to 25, Haifa 18 to 22, Tzfat 15 to 19, Tiberias 21 to 28, Beersheba 18 to 28, and in Eilat from 21 degrees tonight, going up to 35 degrees Celsius tomorrow. Taking another look at the news headlines, Prime Minister Netanyahu says Israel will do what it must to defeat its enemies, including in Rafah. Israel awaits the Hamas response to the latest hostage release and ceasefire proposal. The IDF Chief of Staff and Defense Minister agree on a round of senior general staff command appointments. National Security Minister Ben-Gvir, in response, calls on the Prime Minister to fire the Defense Minister. Turkey is reportedly suspending all trade ties with Israel. U.S. President Biden slams violent college campus protests and says they won't prompt policy change on the region. National Security Council raises the travel advisory for Malmo, Sweden, ahead of the Eurovision Song Contest. No significant change through Saturday. That's the news. Join us tomorrow night at 8 p.m. on Kan Reka, the foreign languages channel of the Israeli Public Broadcasting Corporation. Watch our 2 p.m. news flash on the Kan English Facebook page. Find us on Spotify, X, or write to us at kanenglish@kan.org.il. Together with sound engineer Michael Olschwang, this is Nomi Segal wishing you good evening and shalom from Jerusalem.